martyrs of the Reformation were killed. And we noticed how hard it was to keep the Reformation out from the Netherlands, because it was an area which lived by its great commerce. And the great taxes from this commerce contributed much to Charles V. You could not absolutely close up that territory without destroying it just about altogether. That did nearly happen later on. But at this time, Charles did not go to such extreme measures. And he managed to keep his popularity with the people of the Netherlands, despite the great number who suffered for their faith. But the Lutheran teaching spread widely through the Netherlands, and then the views of other branches of the Reformation came later into this area. Number four is Sweden. We will not be able to take much time on Sweden, but it is such an interesting development. I really wish we could take more. I'm going to tell briefly, but try to bring out a few of the important developments in the way the Reformation came into Sweden. It is quite unique. I'll call small a under that, the Union of Kalmar, K-A-L-M-A-R. This is a political event long before the Reformation, but we need it for background. The Union of Kalmar. In 1397, Sweden, Norway, and Denmark were brought under the control of the rulers of Denmark. And the during the following century, the rulers of Denmark tried to hold Sweden under their control, and sometimes were quite successful and other times not nearly so successful. To this day, in Norway, there are two languages spoken. Southern Norway, they speak a language that's greatly affected by Denmark, by Danish. In northern Norway, there is a different language, which is not so much affected by Danish. And the two languages are used in that country of Norway, showing the effect of this union. Now, in Sweden, it was much harder for the Danes to hold Sweden under their control. And so, by the end of the 15th century, shortly before the Reformation, the power over Norway had become largely nominal. But there was a local ruler in Norway, subject in Sweden, Norway was quite strong, but in Sweden there was a local ruler subject to the king of Sweden, but he was almost independent and quite strong in his control of Sweden. Then at the beginning of the 16th century, there came a sharp dispute between the local ruler and the local archbishop. The archbishop, who was head over the church in Sweden, objected to the local ruler's attitudes. The two became bitter enemies, and the archbishop threw his support to the Danish king, who wished to control Sweden. We'll call small b the bloodbath. The bloodbath, that is the name that has been given to an event that occurred in 1520. The local ruler in Sweden gained practically complete independence from Denmark, and the archbishop left the country and went to Rome and persuaded Pope Leo X to excommunicate the leaders in Sweden, and thus to throw his support to the Danish desire to control Sweden, and also that of the local archbishop. The result was that the king of Denmark, Christian II, he was called, Christian II, who desired to establish real control over Sweden, went with an army and attacked, a large army entered Sweden and gradually conquered one section after another of the country, until eventually the local nobles saw that they had no hope of winning against his strong force, and he made peace proposals. And Christian said that he would completely forgive, would give complete amnesty to all the nobles who had resisted him. And he would forgive them for their opposition to the Danish power if now they would come under his control. And they saw little hope of escaping it, So they agreed to this, and he said, we're going to have a great cooperation, a great time of happiness together. We will have a three-day banquet, and I'll give you complete amnesty. And so they had this great banquet at which he gathered all the leading nobles of Sweden and all that were in the country, which was practically all of them. And they had this great banquet that lasted for 3 days and declared how wonderful it was that now they were one. They were completely forgiven for their opposition to the Danish throne. And then, after 3 days, at the end of the banquet, by prearrangement between the King of Denmark and the Archbishop rose and said, hey, Your Majesty, he said, you have been very, very lenient and gracious in forgiving all these people for their revolt against you, giving them complete amnesty. But he said, you've overlooked one thing. Christian said, what is that? He said, the fact that these people are also rebels against the church. And they have been, Pope has declared them to be under excommunication, and they have rebelled against the church, and you have no power to give them amnesty for that. And Christian said, I guess you're right, aren't you? And before any of the nobles could rise to object, soldiers rushed in and seized them and hustled them off to prison. And so they were put in prison, put through the form of a trial the next day, and then more than 80 of the nobles, including some of the bishops who had stood with the local people against the archbishop, were taken out to the public square a few at a time and were there executed. And thus it seemed as if all the natural leadership of Sweden had been killed by this action of Christian II, and he could control Denmark completely now, or Sweden rather, completely now. And he sailed back to Denmark, leaving a force in the land with garrisons here and there, but figuring there's no real leadership that could do any great harm to him. But small c is Gustavus Vasa. And it so happened that a young man, Gustavus Vasa, you don't know how to spell Swedish? Gustavus, G-U-S-T-A-V-U-S. G-U-S-T-A-V-U-S, Gustavus. And then his last name is Vasa, V-A-S-A, Gustavus Vasa. You might put after that the dates 1523 to 60, and I'll explain later what we mean by those dates. But you could write them down at this point here. 1523 to 1560. This happened in 1520, and it so happened that this young man, Gustavus Vasa, was out of the country at the time. Otherwise, he would have been at the banquet, and he would have been killed with the rest. His father and his uncle were killed, and his brother-in-law. And he heard what had happened. He came back to Sweden, and he began to go around among the peasants, trying to rouse them against the Danish control. And a great deal of the time, he would work in the fields, and he dressed like a peasant, and kept his identity unknown except to those to whom he revealed himself for over a year while he was going about arousing feeling among the people, getting them to stand with him. A young man of very great ability, and eventually he succeeded in gathering a sufficient force that they were able to defeat the various Swedish garrisons and to gain control of the country. Whether they could hold it, various Danish garrison, for some time. Whether they could hold it permanently or not would depend partly on their resources. And he saw that the condition in Sweden was much like that in many countries of Europe, where people would give large sums of money and large plots of land to the church, and great parts of the wealth of the country was held by the church, and they had to have more for the state if they were ever going to gain their freedom and to maintain it. Gustavus also was in good friendly terms with some young men who had studied at Wittenberg under Luther. And he knew about the bloodbath. He knew about the attitude of the archbishop. He felt that Luther was right, but he did not wish to put his head against a stone wall, making one great gesture of defiance and then disappear. He wanted to accomplish something that would last. And consequently, he kept his ideas on this to himself to quite an extent for a time, but in 1523, he was crowned as King of Sweden. And now we will mention one of these young men, small d, Petri, P-E-T-R-I. Petri was one who had studied with Luther. There were some others who had also. I simply pick his name as representative of them. He came back from his studies at Wittenberg, began to preach Reformation teachings, and when the some of the church leaders objected, the king protected them. There were others who were doing this, and the king protected them and put them in important positions in the churches. And he extended their position, the power of these men. They made a translation into Swedish of the Bible. They presented Reformation teaching, began to get more and more support. Now we come to small e, the Diet of 1527. In 1527, a meeting was held of the leaders of Sweden. And at this diet in Sweden, the leaders of the church who had favored Gustavus for king, many of them had been very glad of his winning their freedom from Sweden, but they didn't like the way he was allowing Protestant preaching. They didn't like the way that he was introducing innovations into the church. And so they presented to the Diet their complaints against his religious policy. And the Diet, by a majority action, they decided that the old situation should remain, that innovations in religion should not be permitted, and that his seizing some of the monastery lands where the members had become very few and combining to, and then taking over the unused property and that sort of thing, that must not go on any longer. And when they did this, Gustavus stood up and he said, if I am unable to develop the nation as I feel it should be, to bring it in line with truth as I understand it, he said, there's nothing I can do but to resign from being king. And so he said, repay me for my own resources which I spent in winning your independence and getting the nation established. Again, repay me for that, and I will leave the country for good. And he started off. And I understand that in subsequent years there has been a celebration or a memorial of this situation that has been held, because after he left, the Diet decided that overwhelming majority decided they needed Gustavus so much and thought so highly of him that they would give him the powers that he wanted rather than risk leaving. And so the action was reversed, and he was given a free hand in these measures if only he would come back, assume the kingship, and continue. And men went off on skis through the mountains, rushing to try to catch up with him and bringing him back. And I understand that there has been frequently since a festival at which there's a race on skis remembering, a long distance race remembering this, how they brought him back, and now he had full power to carry out the reforms that he desired. Now, Gustavus was fortunate in living until 1560, so he had plenty of time to do slowly and carefully the things that he thought were important. When there would be a monastery in which the number of monks would sink to less than half, another which was in the same situation, he would move the monks from one of them to the other and then would take over that monastery and its land. When an important place in the church would become vacant, he would put into it a man who was a follower of the Reformation. He protected the Reformation ministers and encouraged them, but he gradually changed the situation of the Swedish church. So that in the end, without any sudden great overturning, the whole church of Sweden was devoted to the Reformation. People trained under Luther were in the leadership. People trained under them were in nearly all of the positions of importance in the Swedish church. Now we look at quite a different situation which occurred in Denmark. That will be five. And it's a very different situation in Denmark, but the result in both countries was that within 50 years, both countries were solidly devoted to the teachings of Luther. But now, number five, Denmark, we note there, small a, the nearness to Germany. Denmark was right next to Germany. It was a very simple thing for students to go to the University of Wittenberg. In fact, there were 19 Danish students at Wittenberg in the time just before the Diet of Worms, when Luther had put up his theses and when he was developing the beginnings of the movement. Many Danish students were trained there and knew much about the Reformation. Then, small b, the corruptness of the clergy. There was the clergy had become very corrupt in many countries. In Germany, you would find at the beginning of the Reformation, there were areas where there were people in the clergy who were very spiritual and very much interested in the biblical teaching and the advancement of the people, and other areas where they were extremely corrupt. And there's this variety all over Europe, but much widespread corruption. And it so happened that in Denmark and in Scotland, comparatively small areas, they happened to be in areas where the corruption was particularly great. And this affected the people as a whole and their readiness to support the Reformation teachings that came in. So small c is the great leader of the Reformation in Denmark was Tausen, capital T-A-U-S-E-N, Tausen. Great leader who had studied in Wittenberg from 1519 to 1521, who did much to advance the Reformation there. Small d, the attitude of Christian II. Christian II was the king who carried out the bloodbath in Sweden. And you would think from what he did in Sweden that he was a very solid supporter of the Pope and of the established church, but actually he was just as wide awake to its corruption as anyone. And he saw this an opportunity to gain his political ends, but he no sooner got back to Denmark than he sent to Luther asking him to send some men up to Denmark to teach the Reformation teaching in Denmark. And Luther at the time had all he could do where he was and was unable to do anything to help him right then. But Christian II was soon found himself facing great dislike among the people of Denmark, and in 1523 he was driven out from his position, and his uncle was elected to choose him to follow him, Frederick I. And he was king of Denmark from 1523 to 1532. Now, Frederick I in Denmark carried on quite an enlightened policy. There is no evidence that he himself actually was a direct follower of Luther, but he was very much disgusted with the corruption in the church, and his son had been at the Diet of Worms and had been very much attracted by Luther's stand and Luther's teaching. And he permitted the coming in of Reformation teaching. He refused to allow it to be stopped by force. E is Peterson's New Testament. In a man named Peterson, a Dane who had studied the Reformation teachings, made a translation of the New Testament into Danish. And this had a great influence in spreading the Reformation teaching. if the debates in 1530. In 1530, when there was much division within the country as to what was should be done about this, the king said, let us have a debate, and let Luther send some of his men to present their view, and let the local clergy present their view on the points at issue. And the local clergy was very corrupt and enjoying their own pleasures, much like the popes were at this time, and actually had very little idea of any real argument on the matters under consideration. While the men who came to represent the Protestant view were keen men who were well trained and thoroughly understood the issues, and in the debate, it was very obvious that they were successful. This is one thing in the early days of the Reformation. The reformers were keen, wide awake, interested in the issues, while a great numbers on the other side were simply interested, like Leo X and Clement VII, in their own pleasures, and this was quite incidental to them. Now, that was something that was changed within another 30 years. You had on the Romanist side men just as keen as anybody on the other side, and perhaps better trained. But at the beginning, you didn't have it. And so in Denmark, the debates advanced the cause of the Reformation, and when Frederick was succeeded by his son Christian III, there was a man there who was devoted to the Reformation. And under his kingship, Luther sent one of his leading men to Denmark for 3 years to organize the church in Denmark and to try to establish conditions in such a way that the teachings of the Bible would be advanced in every possible way. Now, Christian II, by the way, after a few years in exile, managed to get some support from some of his friends, came back with an army and tried to get himself reestablished as king of Denmark, but he was defeated and taken captive, and he spent the last 20 or 30 years of his life in prison until he lived a rather long life, but a very disagreeable one, finally died there in prison. Now, I think it is very interesting to see the difference between the Danish and the Swedish church. In Sweden, the change came very gradual. It came because the king permitted the biblical preachers to spread their teaching, protected them, put them into positions of importance in the church, eventually gave them complete control over the education of the country, and there was just a gradual change. While in Denmark, there were these great clashes between the two forces, and the old clergy was entirely swept out, and the men whom Luther sent organized the church absolutely anew. And the result is that the Church of England, in the last 300 years, has recognized the Swedish church as a church that has apostolic succession. And any Swedish person who's ordained in the Swedish church could preach in an Anglican church, but the Danish church, they lost their apostolic succession. So they were not recognized, and they could not speak in an Anglican church. Yes?
Did you say that Frederick III took over from Frederick I's father?
No, Christian Frederick. Yes, took over from his father Frederick I. Danish church thus makes no claim to apostolic succession. Everyone recognizes the Swedish church has it. But both of them were countries in which the Reformation had great effect, and the moral life of both nations was raised to a very, very high level. I was crossing the ocean on a plane about 10 years ago, and someone sitting next to me in the plane was reading in a guidebook written by someone who didn't evidently have very high ideals. And this book said that there were certain countries like Denmark and Switzerland, which had such disgustingly high moral standards, it said, that if you were to leave a $50 bill on the sidewalk and go away, and you came back 2 years later, it would still be there. Nobody would have touched it, nothing would have been done, no change would have been made, unless perhaps the government had installed a soldier there just in case some foreigner were to think of taking it. Well, both in Sweden and in Denmark and in the northern part of Switzerland, the moral standards and the standards of honesty became way ahead of those in the Romanist countries, and remained so until within the last few years. Within the last few years, modernism has swept into these nations like a flood, and there's very little true biblical teaching in them anymore, and the result has been shown in the change in the moral conditions and the general attitude. And morally, Sweden has, from being perhaps as having as high standards perhaps 100 years ago as any nation in the world, is now in some regards among the lowest standards of any nation in the world. And the change has taken place as a result, of course, of the spread of modernism and the dropping down of biblical teaching. In both of them, Christianity is today at a very low end, but they both had three centuries in which they were as Christian nations as anywhere in the world. Well, now, that was six, that was five, Denmark. Six is Poland. Poland, is the story of the Reformation in Poland is a very, very sad story. I wish we had time to go into it fully, but if we did, it would be difficult to get the material to go into it fully, because the Counter-Reformation in the end went out so completely in Poland that it's even difficult to find the material about the event. But at the beginning, the Reformation made as good a start in Poland as in any country in the world. Luther's books were read all over Poland. Great numbers of people came to follow the Reformation teaching. Great many numbers of the nobility followed it. Protestant leaders from Poland were even called to England to help in the Reformation. It was made one of the finest starts in the Reformation of any nation. And then through the clever and very great industry, cleverness and very great industry of the Jesuit movement, which we look at later, it was almost completely rooted out of Poland. And the, as I say, one of the saddest stories anywhere in history is this nation, which made such a promising start in becoming a great Protestant country, had it almost completely wiped out later. Then number seven is France. And I have assigned you material in about Lefebvre, Brissonnet, Burquin, some of the other French leaders. And you've read in it about Francis I and his attitude, and about his sister Margaret, who supported the Reformation to so great an extent. Francis I at first inclined to follow his sister, while he did not accept biblical teachings himself. He was ready to give tolerance and desired that the Reformation be not interfered with to a great extent. But then in October 1534, some very ardent Protestants put up placards all over Paris that the Mass was a wicked idolatry and an insult to God, very inflammatory pamphlets. And in the morning when Francis got up, he found one of them was on the very door of his bedchamber. And he was so incensed about this that he ordered a great procession in honor of the Mass, in which he walked and carried a candle, and anyone who was even connected with anyone who might conceivably have put up the placards was arrested. And many of them were executed, and Francis became quite a strong persecutor from that time on, even though his sister still continued her strong support of the Reformation. And her daughter became an even stronger supporter than she was, and then her son became King of France and gave the Reformation absolute freedom in France. But we'll look at the sad story of him later on. Since much of this you're reading in your book, I'm not going to take time to repeat it here, but I do want you to be familiar with it. Number eight is Switzerland. And we have already noticed a little about Zwingli at Zurich. And Reformation got an early start in Switzerland. In Switzerland, the various sections had won their freedom from the Austrian emperor within the previous two centuries. They were quite disunited on the whole, the different sections of Switzerland with the large mountains around. It wasn't worth the effort to try to bring them in complete subjection, and they didn't interfere with the emperor so long as he didn't interfere with them. And so the Reformation spread through the cities of the northern part of Switzerland, but in the mountain areas it was stopped. And you remember how it was the men from the mountain areas, 8,000 of them, who fought an army of 2,000 from Zurich, with which Zwingli was chaplain when Zwingli was killed in 1531. But the mountain people were not sufficiently incited against the Reformation to go on to try to interfere with it to any great extent in the lower areas. After they had won their great victory, then a peace was made, which they didn't interfere with each other much. They simply prevented the Reformation from being spread in their areas much, but in the more northern areas, it gained control very soon in Zurich, in Bern, in Basel, in these parts of German Switzerland. It spread to French Switzerland, is something we will look more at later, because it came a little bit later. Number nine is Italy. And in Italy, in the south of Italy, Spain had held Sicily and the southern end of Italy for some centuries before this time. And some of the Spaniards who were influenced by Luther's teaching began preaching Reformation teachings in this area. And one of them wrote a book on the sufferings of Christ, which was a presentation of justification by faith, of which there were 40,000 copies distributed all through Italy. The Reformation got a wonderful start in Italy. And then the Counter-Reformation later on closed right in and seized every copy of this book and destroyed them. And 100 years ago, it was thought there wasn't a single copy of the book left. Then one was found in the British Museum. But completely blotted it out of Italy, but before they did, it had a very good start. Number 10, Spain. In Spain, it didn't get as good a start as it did in Italy. But nevertheless, there was a real start. Some of the Spanish soldiers and some of the Spanish leaders would sit in the court in Spain with a cover of a book that showed some licentious pictures and looked like a rather low type of novel they were reading, so nobody would interfere with them. But all they had was this cover, and inside of it they'd have one of Luther's books, which they were reading. And it got a good start in Spain, but then the Inquisition in Spain wiped it out completely. Now, capital O, political developments from 1532 to 1544. Now we go back to Germany again, and we notice number one, the emperor's attitude. The emperor's attitude was as you know, not that he wished the Pope to be supreme, not at all, but he wished to have one church, and he wanted it to be mostly in line with the medieval tradition. And so the emperor was determined to destroy Protestantism if he could get freedom from his obligations in a military way. But he was willing to make considerable concessions if he could get unity. And in fact, what he desired was to have a general council in which all the theologians would be represented and in which they would work out what is the true teaching, which he thought would be very like the teaching that was taught in Rome, but he thought there might be some changes, and then that they would all unite on this and he would enforce it. That's what he desired, and he was working in that direction. Now, number two, the new Pope, Clement VII, who had been like Leo X, without Leo X's attractiveness, without Leo X's ability, but with just as much desire only for his own pleasures and the advancement of his family. Clement VII died in 1534, and a different type of pope came in, Paul III. Paul III was determined to find a way to work it out so that the church would recover its control. And he made a big start in that direction in the succeeding years when he was Pope. So you have the beginning of the Counter-Reformation with his activities. We look at that later. Number three, conferences on religion. The emperor had several conferences held in Germany, in which there were to be Romanist champions and Protestant champions to meet and discuss the matters at issue and see if they couldn't get together. And they would each try to make a statement that expressed what they believed, but that the others could accept. And in the end, they only worked out means of expressing their beliefs in such a way that it would sort of hide it, and that others could, to some extent, agree with it. But these conferences did crystallize their understanding of the division, of the difference between them. And at one of these, Luther couldn't go to any of these conferences. Of course, he was under the ban of the empire, but Melanchthon was active in them. And a young man named Calvin took part in one of them, and there became a close friend of Melanchthon. So Melanchthon, who Luther thought was the greatest leader in the movement that he headed, became a very close friend of the young John Calvin. Number four is the change in Ducal Saxon. The change in Ducal Saxon. Now you remember that Ducal Saxony is the area north of Electoral Saxony. These two had been one region. There had been a Duke of Saxony who had divided it between his two sons. And in the time of Luther, the two grandsons were in control. Frederick the Wise in the southern part, Electoral Saxony, the poorer part, the part without the big cities, without the great universities. But to make up for them, he had the electorship. The northern part was his somewhat younger cousin, Duke George, who was one of the bitterest enemies of the Reformation. You could not cut off communication between these two. It was a very artificial line that divided the two, and the people all had relatives both sides. They were always crossing back and forth. On the southern side, everybody was reading Luther's works. Most everybody was adopting Luther's views. The people on the northern side naturally got his books, and the booksellers in Leipzig, I already mentioned to you, sent a petition to Duke George to let them sell Luther's books, because they said, we're losing all the business. They said, the business is all going to the people in outside of here. People are reading them anyway. Why can't we sell them? Duke George said, these books must be stopped. There must be no Reformation teaching in this land. He was adamant. He was bitterly opposed to Luther, but nevertheless, Luther's works could not be kept out. They disseminated through the area. His own brother, Henry, who was only a little younger than he was, became an ardent supporter of Luther. And so Duke George, as he began to feel that the end of his life was approaching, he became very much disturbed as to what would happen to the region after he was gone. His oldest son was an extreme alcoholic, but he was a man who hated Luther, who said, if you think my father was strong against you, you'll find I'm twice as strong. And in 1538, he was determined he was going to hold the line solidly in the land when he took over. But he died in 1538, and his father then turned to the younger son, who was a semi-idiot. And of course, nobody expected him to succeed, but the father tried to make it that he would succeed, and then he suddenly died. And then George turned to his brother Henry, and he said, Henry, I will make you my successor if you will give a solemn promise to support the established church, to thoroughly support the Pope, and to turn completely against Luther. And the messenger came to Henry to tell him that. Henry turned to his friend, and he said, Satan is offering me the kingdoms of this world if I will fall down and worship him. And he refused to do it. And George said, well, if Henry won't do this, he said, I'm going to leave my realm to the emperor's brother, Ferdinand, who was a very strong enemy of the Reformation, and who was the Duke of Austria, and so he had papers drawn up to declare that his brother Henry should not succeed, but that his realm should go to be turned over to the emperor's brother. And the men brought in the papers for his signature, and as they came toward him with the papers, he dropped back and died on the bed. And so Henry, his brother, was the next in line. All this happened within a few months before his death. Henry was the next in line. Henry immediately sent word to Luther, come right up here immediately. And they had a big service in the main church at which Luther preached. He introduced other supporters of the Reformation all through the area. The great bulk of the people were already wishing to support the Reformation. Luther organized a visitation of the churches to see which of the people understood the Bible and were ready to present his teachings and which didn't, and those were displaced. And so all of Saxony became devoted to the Reformation in 1539. Then, five, the Peace of Crepy, C-R-E-P-Y. The Peace of Crepy, 1544. In 1544, the emperor was able to make a peace with the French, and though he had been victorious in his fighting, he gave them he was very generous with them, gave them certain concessions, but made them make a solemn promise they would unite with him in wiping out the Reformation, which he was so anxious to do. And so, number six, the emperor finds his opportunity to crush Protestantism. Having made this peace, having very astutely and carefully arranged so that he would be safe from the machinations of the popes who had been working against him behind his back, safe from attack from France, and in a situation where he could have his hands free to crush Protestantism, the emperor began to look for an opportunity to get some of the Protestant princes separated from others, get disagreements among them that he could take advantage of. And Henry of Saxony had died, and his son was very ambitious. And the emperor made an arrangement with him whereby he would support the emperor. The emperor promised not to interfere with his religion or the religion in his area. And so here was his opportunity to crush Protestantism, and within the next few years, he completely gained control of the whole land. But by this time, the teachings of the Bible were so deeply inculcated in the minds of so many of the people that it was just impossible to do what he could quite easily have done 15 years earlier if he had been able to be free from his external difficulties. Now we go on to capital P, Luther's church building activities. All this time, Luther had been very active in spreading of the knowledge of the truth and in the getting the teaching spread more widely in the various churches. But number one of the greatest things Luther did was his Bible translation. We've already mentioned this, but we must mention it again because he never ceased to the end of his life giving great attention to Bible translation. He studied his Greek, his Hebrew, constantly, and he was constantly figuring how to get this into Germany. For instance, he would go to the meat market, and he would see them killing the animals, and he would ask the names of the different parts of the animal and so on, and then study when he was working on Leviticus in order to try to get just the right words in German for the translation of all those things in Leviticus. In every part of the Bible, he was constantly studying, how can I get this thought across in the German language? And the translation that he made was the foundation of the modern German language, and it was a very carefully planned and worked out translation which had a tremendous effect on German ever since. Number two, hymns. Luther saw that a great way to spread the truth was by singing. And he felt that the singing should not be, as it is in most of the Roman churches, simply a choir that sings and the people listen. He saw the great advantage of congregational singing. And so he began to write hymns. As early as 1523, he got out a small hymn book. He got a second hymn book in 1528. He wrote many hymns. And then he looked for good hymns by others. And some of one of his hymns, of course, his great Reformation hymn, has been translated to many languages and is one of the best known hymns. And then there's his cradle hymn that he wrote for his children, the Christmas song, that is in most of our hymn books, though some question whether he wrote it. So some hymn books say Martin Luther and others say unknown. I would imagine that in translating it, someone may have made considerable change. So just how well, how much it goes back to Luther is hard to prove. But he wrote many hymns, two or three great ones, a number that were very excellent. And he worked much on the planning of the services so as to have the people participate and so as to drive the truths of the scripture into people's hearts. Number three, his catechisms. Luther wrote catechisms in order that the children should learn these and should have the truth of the scripture put into clear, simple language. I 2 years ago in Heidelberg, I went into a class taught by a man I didn't know anything about. The Heidelberg is a rather radical university, and I didn't expect really Christian teaching, and yet I have heard since that it is the custom in most of the German universities, if it's a radical university, to have one conservative, and if it's a conservative university, to have one radical on the faculty. And I don't know anything about this particular man that I heard, but he gave a very excellent lecture on a certain point of theology, and as he faced the students, he said to them, he said, now as we look at this subject, he said, I'm going to read a sentence from Luther's little catechism. Now he said, gentlemen, do not be astonished that I read from the catechism. He said, actually, writing a catechism is one of the hardest things to do, to put the truth into simple, clear language that exactly expresses it. He says, I myself would never think of trying to write a catechism. And I thought it was very interesting the way he spoke this way, and took the words of this part of Luther's catechism and used it as the foundation for his very interesting lecture, something I hadn't expected to find in present-day Heidelberg. But Luther's catechisms had tremendous influence in the succeeding years until modernism came in and made a great change, of course. Number four is visitations. Visitations. Luther suggested that to the elector that he send a group of men to visit the different churches, to talk to the priests, to the leaders in the churches, to see what they knew and whether they were presenting the gospel, whether they really understood the gospel. And thus these visitations would just make suggestions for changes, and if necessary, they would recommend to the elector that the local man be removed and someone else be put in his place. But these visitations and these instructions they carried out there, and the same policy was followed in Denmark and in Sweden and other areas. In this connection, though, we must mention Luther's health difficulties. That any man could go through the strain of the situations he went through, never knowing how long he would live, it would destroy the nerve strength of most men. And Luther worked so tremendously hard that the whole thing together, as early as 1523, began to set in, give him dizziness, ringing in the ears, sleeplessness, kidney stones, bladder stones, indigestion, gout, rheumatism. Why, it's terrible what he suffered from during these years, but he pressed on, working hard in spite of his tremendous health difficulties. Sometimes he was laid up for fairly long periods, but he had many long periods of uninterrupted work, and he accomplished a tremendous amount. Number six is his personal influence. I'm not going to start to tell you the story of the legate's visit, but the representative of the Pope made a visit to the to Luther once. And the Catholic Encyclopedia tells how this man visited Luther and how the clever Italian saw right through Luther and saw Luther's weakness. Luther had a long chain around his neck and different things that he made fun of in his letters to the Pope. But you read Luther tells how he said what he was going to do to make an effect on this legate. And they talked together, and I looked up the man in the back of the Catholic Encyclopedia in the index, and it said Italian apostate. So the article on Luther spoke about how he saw through Luther and how he wrote to the Pope about Luther's weaknesses. So they said Italian apostate, and Luther said to him how he said, what would you do with the Pope if you had him in your power? And Luther said, there's nothing I'd like better than to preach him to give him the gospel, and I wish he might accept it. And he said, I wish the same thing for the Pope's legate. And later on, this man was made a bishop of a large area of northern Italy, and word got to Rome that he was teaching justification by faith. And orders were sent to him to come down to Rome for examination, but several others had by that time been burned for their views. He disguised himself and headed north up to Switzerland and became a Protestant minister. And just in a brief visit, Luther laid the seeds of the truth in his mind to such an extent that they sprouted out in this way. And Luther had a few people who were so interested in everything he would say that after the dinner was over, they'd go upstairs and write down everything they could remember. And so there are a couple of volumes that have been published of Luther's Table Talk, and it has what these people could remember of what he says. And some people nowadays will grab a few sentences out of this and try to represent Luther as having ideas and attitudes that I don't think he had. But it does give you an interesting idea of his tremendous personal influence. Well, we continue there next Tuesday.